Life in the Barbaro, when Patricia Curtis grew up there, was not typical of life elsewhere in Venice at that time, even in other palaces. It was the 1950s, Patricia said, and by then, no more than a dozen Venetian families were still using gondolas. The Cinis, the De Cazes, the Berlingeris, the Volpis, and Peggy Guggenheim. The Barbaro of Patricia Curtis's childhood was populated by a dozen servants or more. In addition to the gondoliers, there were two butlers, a majordomo, a cook, an assistant cook, two maids, a nurse, a handyman, and a laundress. The maids wore black and white uniforms and shoes called friulane, which were like espadrilles and made no sound as they moved around the palace. The servants were devoted to my parents, she said. Rosa would always insist on waiting up for my mother and father when they dined out. She withheld the house keys from them, offering the excuse that they were far too big and heavy to be tucked into the pocket of a gentleman's dinner jacket. And when my parents returned home, she would insist on serving them hot lemonade. During World War II, the Italian government sequestered the Barbaro, and as enemy aliens, we were not permitted to live here. But Rosa and Angelo stayed in the palace and looked after it faithfully. We were in Paris when the war broke out, and my father decided to take us directly to New York. We didn't know if we'd ever see the Barbaro again. The Venetian superintendents came, crated the art, and took it to the Doge's palace, where it would be safe. The Japanese military attaché used the piano nobile for a headquarters and covered the dining room walls with framed photographs of Japanese warplanes in action, including kamikaze planes. But Rosa cleverly hid the silver and other valuables, and Angelo sealed off the entrance to the library on the top floor so convincingly that people who occupied the Barbaro during the war never even knew the room existed. When my parents came back to Venice after the war, Rosa proudly took them around the palace to show them that everything had been returned to its pre-war condition. She had even taken the photographs of the Japanese warplanes off the dining room walls and stacked them away. We left the ballroom through an enfilade of doors into the master bedroom suite on the corner. These were the royal chambers, majestic in scale and prospect. Two tall balconied windows on the Grand Canal, side windows looking out over a narrow rio along the side of the palace, brocaded walls and furniture from the time of the Barbaros. Before I left, Patricia took me through her own apartment, one floor above, the apartment that would still be hers, even after the piano nobile had been sold. It had the same floor plan as the piano nobile, minus the ballroom, which gave it a broad, sunny central hall with spacious rooms on both sides and, in all, 8 windows on the Grand Canal. The ceilings were lower, the walls were decorated with simple but elegant moldings, and yet by any standard, even for Venice, this was a superb apartment. At one point, we walked into one of the guest bedrooms, and I became aware that Patricia was watching me for my reaction, now more than before. And immediately, I saw why. On the wall in front of us, there was a full-length portrait of a young woman in a strapless, white gown. The pose was the first thing that drew my attention. It was almost identical to the exuberant pose of Isabella Stuart Gardner in the famous portrait of her, painted at the Barbaro, by Anders Zorn. Arms outstretched to the sides as she pushed open a pair of double doors and came sweeping into the Salone from one of the balconies on the Grand Canal. The brushwork in the painting was reminiscent of Sargent's style. I was fairly certain this was the portrait that Ralph had mentioned to me. "Is that you?" I asked. "Yes, I was wearing my debutante dress."
"And who painted it?"
"A man named Charles Merrill Mount," she said.
"Do you know him?"